Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is February 23rd, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 4107. Yay. And this is just a work session. I would like to call Lynn Sexton, and I just had it.
Please proceed.
Chair Bonna Sanderson, Vice Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the Director of the Oregon Health Authority. And we appreciate the opportunity to provide additional testimony today regarding our concerns about the potential budget impacts of House Bill 4107A, specifically if passed with the A5 amendments. OHA and the Department of Justice believe that the A5 amendments may significantly impact the Oregon Health Plan, coordinated care organizations, and the Oregon Health Authority. OHA does support the -4 amendment because it is prospective to only January 1st, 2017, contract rate amendments. And we have several points we'd like to highlight. When first approved by the House, OHA believed the intent of House Bill 4107 was to memorialize for 2017 what was always a key Oregon Health Authority consideration during the 2015 rate redevelopment process. That is, to avoid the possibility of overpayment or an invalid CCO contract amendment and their recoupment in the future in order to stabilize the Oregon Health Plan. Representative Davis's floor speech and comments by Family Care have made clear that OHA was incorrect in its assumptions about the bill's intent. By stating that the intended effect of House Bill 4107 is to nullify language in the 2016 amendments to CCO contracts, the proponents of House Bill 4107 have made clear that the intent is to circumvent key contract provisions required by OHA in order to comply with federal law. This intent has drawn significant concern from the Department of Justice, and OHA can only support legislation with prospective impact on any future contract amendment. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has indicated that it cannot approve any CCO contract amendment that does not include the revised payment rates approved by CMS in December of 2015. More importantly, CMS has also indicated that it would likely consider any payments made by the state to a CCO without an approved contract rate amendment to be unauthorized. If this bill prevented the Oregon Health Authority from recovering any such unauthorized payment, there will be an impact, significant impact, to Oregon State General Fund. As detailed in the fiscal impact statement, this impact could be in excess of $500 million from Oregon State General Fund. At this time, the only CCO that has not signed the CMS-approved 2015 contract rate amendment is Family Care. Family Care is also the only CCO that has not repaid the overpayment, which is then paid to the federal government, or entered into a repayment plan. For all of their 15 CCOs in Oregon, their 2015 contract rate amendments are signed, and their 2015 rates are approved by CMS. In our conversations with CMS and its lawyers, CMS has indicated they will be offering a written determination of how they will resolve this outstanding 2015 rate redetermination issue. It's anticipated CMS will provide guidance within the next few weeks regarding whether the entirety of the federal share of Family Care's 2015 Oregon Health Plan revenue must be returned to the federal government because Family Care does not have a CMS-approved 2015 rate amendment contract in effect, or whether Family Care must return the overpayment due to the difference between rates originally paid to Family Care and the revised rates, which CMS is prepared to approve. As outlined in the fiscal impact statement, OHA believes that there are several possible circumstances that would create a significant fiscal impact to the state of Oregon. If the one remaining 2015 CCO contract rate amendment by Family Care is not signed, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services could determine that OHA does not have a valid CMS-approved contract. If this occurs, the state of Oregon would not be in compliance with federal regulation 42 CFR 438.6 and may be disallowed federal financial payments made to Family Care during 2015. This could require the state of Oregon to repay CMS more than $532 million. If the outstanding CCO contract is signed, but the funds are not recouped from Family Care, the state of Oregon would still be required to repay the federal fund portion of the difference in what was paid to Family Care and what the CMS approved rate is. This would result in $56 million of general fund expenditure. If OHA is not able to make recoupment of the $56 million from Family Care, it may initiate requests from the remaining CCOs for return of their payments of the additional $51 million associated with the 2015 rate redetermination for a total state fund impact of $107 million. In addition to the overarching concerns with the clearly stated intent of House Bill 4107A, and the dash five amendments, OHA also has serious concerns with the additional substantive changes in the A5 amendments that would only allow retroactive contract changes, quote, necessitated by a change, close quote, in federal law, necessitated by a change in, close quote, federal law. This language would seem to preclude amendments necessitated by current federal law. As such, OHA has serious concerns about CMS' willingness to approve future contracts that would seemingly preclude overpayment recoupments. Thank you.
Can you just stay there then?
Yes, ma'am.
And Lori Freeman, will you come forward, please?
So I think there's a disagreement in what I need you to get on record is an unsigned contract or a contract from this bill does not affect any unsigned contract or contract from 2015. Is that your interpretation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Legislative Council. That is absolutely correct. I've said that a number of times. The applicability clause in this bill says it applies to contract terms in effect on the date of the bill's effective date of the bill. The 2015 contract terms have come and gone. So it would not affect the 2015 contract terms. All the probable or prospective financial impacts, that's going to be resolved by a court in the litigation with Family Care. Those are issues that are presently facing our state because of that litigation. But this bill does nothing to change any of that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, thank you very much. Ms. Freeman, thank you. That's helpful. My only concern is there any – actually, I have two concerns. The first is there any chance that there could be – that the bill in its current construction could be interpreted to make it so that it would negate, I'm not even being able to articulate my own question at this point because this stuff is so messy. My concern is that this legislation might make it so that suit would not play itself out in court, and rather that the courts would decide that because this is passed, that and because there is no evidence that CMS required, and I put that term, and that's my next question, required that money be paid back, since they don't state that explicitly in any of their communications, that the courts could say, well, I'm just worried that this is going to play out as part of that court case, and I don't want that to happen.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner here, I simply cannot conceive of any possible way that a court could misconstrue this. My testimony is on the record. Whoever carries this bill, I'm sure, will say on the floor it only applies to 2016 contracts and beyond. I can't even think of a way, if I were representing family care that I would be able to argue that this bill applies to the 2015 contracts. I just don't, I can't even buy a legal argument.
Okay. Madam Chair, quick follow-up. Thank you. And then, Ms. Freeman, the terms of the language in this bill says federal government requires. And my concern is that even with the 2015 issue, I never saw any documentation that CMS in writing required that money to be repaid. I saw a whole list of concerns that they had. I heard about conversations that OHA and some of my colleagues had had with CMS about the fact that they were very concerned and that they really thought this money ought to be repaid. But I never saw anything that said required. And I want to be sure that we're not going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place if we end up in a similar situation in the future. I think that this has been a cautionary experience for everybody, and I would hope that the chances of us ending up in a similar situation in the future are small. But I don't want to end up there and have a CCO say, well, CMS hasn't said anything about them requiring in that exact term. So could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner, Herewood, can you point to where it says required?
Thank you. I may be wrong, but
I guess I'm talking about the part on page 2, line 3. And I can't quite tell whether it still says necessary to comply with federal law or necessitated by a change in federal.
That's
the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, so necessary to comply with federal law. I mean, there was no law, as I understand it, that led the health authority to say that they need to recoup some of the payments for the 2015 contract. There was no change in the law. There was only CMS, who approves our waiver, saying this is what they thought needed to happen. So I guess the question is, under the terms of this bill, if a similar situation arose in the future, would OHA have a leg to stand on to recoup those funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, this is a perfect example of why our office resists using ambiguous terms. I could argue it either way. There are regulations that require that the rate setting be done in a certain way, and it's my understanding that was the basis for which CMS had concerns, was because of the way we were doing the rate setting was not actuarially sound. So I could argue on the one hand that in order to get the rates actuarially sound, it was required by federal law.
Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. I'm not trying to be difficult, Ms. Freeman. I'm really not. I'm just trying to avoid significant unintended consequences, and I appreciate the points that you're trying to make. I guess I'm really careful about language as well, and I worry that a law is different from a rule, because certainly in Oregon, historically, I think we've taken law to mean statute. No? Rules count as laws?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner, who would laws include any regulations, rules, statutes?
Okay.
They would not include guidance or a letter from CMS, but anything that's promulgated or enacted would be a law.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your indulgence.
Okay. Just stay there. I want to know if the committee is ready to work any of the amendments. Yes, Senator. Yeah, okay. Okay. Just briefly again, go over the dash fours and the dash fives and the difference.
Well, in terms of, Madam Chair, in terms of the applicability clause, they both make the bill apply to the terms of contracts that are in effect on the effective date of the bill's passage. So in both cases, it would only apply to 2016 contracts and beyond. The substantive differences between the A4s and the A5s is the A4s would more clearly address what Senator Steiner Hayward was expressing concern about, that if they have to, if CMS requires an amendment, a retroactive amendment as a requirement to approve the contract, that that is another basis on which the contract could be retroactively amended. It also doesn't apply until January 1, 2017. So it would apply to the terms of contracts that are in effect on or after January 1, 2017. The A5, other than changing the applicability, it would also, the substantive change, it would say, would the retroactive amendment would have to be necessitated by a change in federal law. So it wouldn't be just existing set of federal law that they would have to show that there was some change in regulation or statute before they could do the retroactive application. The other thing it does is it has an emergency clause, so it would be effective on passage instead of 91 days after passage, as it currently is in the bill.
So if OHA has an amendment to 2016 contracts dealing with rates and CMS did not approve the rates in the 2016 contracts, would we be in the same situation with the dash fives as we would we have the same problem as in the 2015?
Madam Chair, no, because the dash four amendments don't kick in until next year.
But the dash fives?
The dash fives, yes. If they wanted to adjust the 2016 rates retroactively, the dash fives, A5s, would prohibit that unless the requirements of the statute were met.
Okay, so Ms. Saxton, do you foresee changes in the 2016 contract rates?
No. However, we can't support, given the testimony I just gave, we can support 2017, we cannot support 2016. So if you want to go back to the dash fours, we're happy to look at that.
Okay.
I'm not comfortable with the fives. I'm sorry. I just feel like the unintended consequences.
I've got it. Okay, so what we want to do is the three of us will move and
there's four of us here.
I know, there's four of us. Right, we need to move this to Ways and Means.
Okay.
And so we will take it away.
Are we in work session?
Yes, yeah, we only had a work session.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of adopting the dash A5 amendment into House Bill 4107 without the required fiscal and revenue statements.
So Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules in order to adopt the A5 amendments into 4107. Is there any discussion?
Can I get some clarification? Does that mean it would have to go to Ways and Means?
If I could, Madam Chair, we're going to do that anyway, but that also makes it easier to send it without because they'll get the paperwork down there as well.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
We're just out. Sorry.
Just on the amendment.
Okay. No, we have just suspending the rules.
Suspending the rules. I'm sorry.
Excuse.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Vice
Chair
Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monica Anderson.
Aye. The rules are now suspended.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A5 amendment into House Bill 4107A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A5 amendments into Senate House Bill 4105. Is there any
07.
I mean 07. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the concerns brought forward by the proponents of this bill, and I understand the challenges of certainty in business. And certainly I want to do everything we can to provide that certainty. That being said, I have substantial concerns when the head of the agency that we've charged with helping us control our costs for health care, who is trying hard to work closely with our federal partners, expressed such substantive concerns about this amendment. And I'm glad this is going to Ways and Means, because if I had to guess, there's a ginormous fiscal on it, or at least there's a risk of a ginormous fiscal, to use a technical term. So I'm going to oppose the amendment. If we move to pass the bill out and send it to Ways and Means, I'll agree to that. But I just want to put it on record, I'm not happy with this amendment, and that's why, because I'm all in favor of business certainty, but I think we could accomplish that with the A-4s.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, again, clerk will call the roll on adopting the A-5 amendments.
Senator Knope? Excused.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monica
Anderson? Aye. The amendment is adopted.
Bang your gavel.
Teamwork.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4107A as amended by the -A5 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request the bill be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4107 to the floor with a due pass as amended with the A5s with a due pass recommendation and requests that the bill be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Can I ask one more question, Madam Chair? Do we have assurances from the Senate President's office that this will be sent to Ways and Means?
I've been talking with them and with both amendments, A4s and A5s, that there was going to be a fiscal.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I would also suggest that Senator Bates is anxiously awaiting it in the subcommittee that you serve on. So,
I just hope they can get it there by tomorrow morning so we can do it and not stick it to poor Senator Girard on capital construction.
Any other discussion?
That's
clerk will
point.
Call the roll.
Okay.
Excuse.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye, with the aforementioned reservations.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monica Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I will close the work session on House Bill 4107 and open an informational on Cover All Kids. I'd like to call up Linda Roman and Elizabeth Kuchwa.
Thank you very much. 40 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. For the record,
Ms. Anderson.
Oh, my God. Hi. Hi. Sorry, Chair Lana Sanderson. That conversation just threw me a little bit. I'm Elizabeth Kuchwa, the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon. Children First also coordinates United for Kids, which produces the children's agenda. And this should be the easiest part of your day, I think. Thanks for hearing us. With me is Linda Roman, the Policy Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. We're here today to give you an overview of why extending health care eligibility to all kids in Oregon in 2017 would benefit their education, their economic security, and of course their health. With us today are some certified smart people who will give you a deeper dive into this through each of their areas of expertise. They're part of a broad and deep coalition of more than 68 organizations statewide that all support covering all kids in 2017. Before we begin, please note that throughout this presentation, we'll be using Medicaid often as an example because that's where the data is for low-income and vulnerable children. All children deserve the chance to succeed in school and in life, and as you know, staying healthy is the key to that success.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Cover All Kids and for putting us on the agenda. For the record, my name is Linda Roman. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Government Relations for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. We are a statewide health advocacy organization whose mission is to end Latino health disparities through the sharing of resources, advocacy, and education. The strength of Oregon's strength lies in the communities and success of our children. Our state has made major advances to ensuring more Oregonians have more care that they need to be productive and healthy through the health expansion efforts. These advancements have led to a 9% reduction in ER use by Medicaid patients by CCOs alone in the first year. Over 840 Oregon children are eligible for health care coverage. And since 2009, 100,000 previously uninsured kids have received coverage. These are all substantial gains, and yet lack of health care coverage persists for some of Oregon's children. We have not achieved Cover All Kids. Children without health insurance are less likely to see a doctor and get the care that they need. Through a study done by the Oregon Center for Public Policy and the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, up to 17,600 children are categorically excluded from coverage from the Oregon's Health Care for All Children in Oregon Act. This population is only 2% of all children in Oregon, only 2%. Our goal is to extend health care coverage for all children in Oregon in 2017. Because on day one of school, we need to ensure that children arrive prepared and ready to learn just like any other child. Their health and well-being contributes to their success in school. So why Cover All Kids? Five other states and Washington, D.C. are a testament to the fact that health insurance coverage is key to ensuring that every child succeeds. Oregon can and should ensure that every child is on a pathway to success. We have made progress for some kids, but not all kids. Having health insurance promotes health while preventing needless suffering, economic hardship, and even death for some children. Of the states that share the West Coast, Oregon is the only state that has not covered all kids. When we asked the health industry of the other states, why did you cover all kids? They respond, it is simply the right thing to do. Kids are kids. No child deserves to suffer. As a state, we have substantially decreased the number of uninsured children. We did this in 2009, but left out 2% of kids. Yes, we've made substantial progress. However, our children cannot wait any longer. All children in Oregon should be a priority.
But why does health care coverage matter? Because all kids receiving care, we get closer to the 40-40-20 goal by 2025. So how can expanding health care eligibility do that? In a 2015 study on the 50th anniversary of Medicaid, children who benefited from Medicaid eligibility expansion were 9.7% less to drop out of school. They were also 5.5% more likely to graduate from college. Conversely, the lack of health management in childhood leads to school absences. School absences leads to achievement disparities and higher dropout rates. The less education a child has, the higher his or her health risks as an adult. So it's a vicious circle that begins and ends with poor and poorly managed health. Also, when uninsured children cannot access coverage, they're less likely to have a primary health provider and less likely to see a regular provider. As you know in this committee, nationally, dental problems account for nearly 2 million lost school days every year. Children from low-income families are 12 times more likely to have missed school due to dental problems than their peers from higher-income families.
Economic security. What does health care eligibility have to do with economic security? We have found that Medicaid-eligible children have higher incomes later in life and are more likely to surpass their family's economic status as adults. But what about more direct returns on investment? From the Medicaid at 50 study by Georgetown University, we know that each year of Medicaid eligibility from ages 0 to 18 increased tax payments in adulthood by $186 per person. And the economic report from the Baker Institute says that providing health insurance to low-income children increased consumer spending on average by $800.
Of course, health coverage leads to better health and overall wellness. The lack of health insurance results in unnecessary hospitalization and even increased death rates among children. But childhood health coverage is directly related to the health of adults. Children with access to Medicaid had reduced use of hospitalization and emergency room visits as adults, which led us to recoup 3 to 5% of the initial cost of any Medicaid eligibility expansion in the first year. So it's time to think about these kids and their relationship to our state's future. So if we extend eligibility to health care coverage in 2017, we should truly cover all kids in Oregon.
On behalf of the Cover All Kids statewide network and the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, I would like to thank over the 70 supporting health industry leaders, public policy, children, and community advocates who have joined in support of Cover All Kids. Thank you so much for your leadership.
And in the interest of time, I'd like to invite up our next panel. Bob Stewart is the superintendent of the Gladstone School District, and Nina Fakaris is a Beaverton school nurse, and she's also the president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses.
Thank you very much. So Bob Stewart and Nina Fakaris.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Bob Stewart. I'm superintendent of Gladstone School District. In 2003, I was visiting a third grade teacher, and we were talking about the issues that she faced with her kids, her families. She talked to me about the access to health care, and that she just had a conference with a parent, and the parent didn't know how to access health care. And as a school superintendent, that was foreign to me. The whole concept of how healthcare works was not anything that I ever immersed myself within. And at that time, I gave careful thought to what do we need to do to make sure that our kids have access to healthcare. At that time, I believed what needed to happen is that kids needed to have a health insurance program of some kind. And that was true, but it wasn't the full story. Because the full story was not only did they need to have access with an insurance card that allowed them to have access to health care, they also needed to have access in terms of proximity of a location of a health care. They needed to have a doctor that would see that patient and other things related to access. At that time, I believed those two things would give all of our kids access to health care. Since then, and only recently, did I learn that not all kids have access to health care. I went back and read some articles from 2009 when the health care laws were passed to expand health care to what I perceived to be all kids, and I missed a key word in the article. Because the article said is expand the law to reach virtually all children, not all children. And that's a key word. As you saw, the documentation is very apparent. Our health rooms are full every day, and access to health care is a big issue. I asked our high school principal what were some issues that she sought related to health care, and she was a former middle school principal. What she shared was that in middle school, kids that don't have good access to health care frequent the office all day long to tend to care issues related to their health. In high school, it becomes different. They just don't show up. And if they don't show up, that's a bigger problem. So I would encourage you, I know this is a work session for future, but I would encourage you to think about How do we extend this to all kids, not virtually all kids?
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Chairman Monis-Anderson, senators, thank you for allowing me to come speak with you today. My name is Nina Ficaris, and I'm a school nurse. And I know you've seen me here before talking about school nursing issues. It is my passion because I truly believe it's our role to make sure kids are healthy and safe and ready to learn in their school environment. Schools have changed over the past 30-some years I've been a school nurse. You know, asthma rates are increasing dramatically. It is still one of the leading causes of death among children. It is one of the most preventable causes of death among children. Life-threatening anaphylaxis and allergies is also increasing. And in the 90s, with the invention of auto-injectable epinephrine, schools are now teaching staff to recognize the signs of anaphylaxis and how to administer this life-saving medication. Children with type 1 diabetes, 30 years ago when I started, we didn't have any. 20 years ago when we started getting a few children, we just didn't treat them much at school. Well, now the treatment parameters for children with type 1 diabetes has changed dramatically. We're giving insulin at breakfast, lunch, most snack times. We're counting carbohydrates. We're balancing that with exercise and high blood sugar boluses and low blood sugar snacks. It's really changed what happens in schools. Healthcare is happening in our schools today. You know, they've recently also begun to recognize that some of the social determinants of health and how that is impacting our children. So it's the trauma, it's where they live, it's the poverty, it's the violence, it's all being recognized now as, oh, that could impact our children and the way they learn. In fact, in the recently past federal legislation, the ESSA legislation, they talk about school districts are now becoming required to do trauma-informed approach to education because they're recognizing how much that's impacting our children. With all these acute disease processes, the chronic disease, the mental health trauma, that impacts all children, regardless of the circumstances of their birth. Beaverton School District, we have about 40,000 children, a little more than 40,000 children in our district. A little more than 3,000 of them would directly benefit from Cover All Kids. So 3,000 children in the Beaverton School District would directly benefit from this type of legislation. Just a quick example. Several years ago, I was called in to visit with a fifth grade student who, when I looked at him, had a student teacher working with him one-on-one, and she shared, you know, I think he's just having issues hearing me. So I looked back in his records. Yep, he failed his kindergarten hearing screen, first and second grade hearing screenings. So I catch him at fifth grade. I check his hearing. He failed one week. I checked it the next week. He failed. I had no resources. I finally called my private ENT, who was a great doc. I said, will you please just see this kid for free? I was sure it was a sensory neuro thing. We could get a hearing aid. I knew where I could do that. No, it ended up just being fluid. And he needed surgery, and he just needed tubes. That was a much bigger hurdle. The ENT was able to work with St. Vincent's. We were able to do it at a much reduced cost. Parents paid what they could, and then the parent club from the elementary school picked up the rest of the cost for this child to have tubes. The reason I remember that now is because I just saw him a few weeks ago in my high school. He's a senior, and he's now graduating. So a child who had basically failed elementary education after simple intervention of tubes is now graduating high school. And it just made me feel good. You know, it's like, oh, we got one. We saved one of them. You know, nationally, we have decided that all children in the nation deserve the right to a free and appropriate education. Oregon now has the opportunity to say all children in the state of Oregon deserve and have the right to appropriate health care coverage. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay, Janet Bauer and Dave Underreiner. You're going to talk about economic security.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and indeed I am going to talk about economic security. Thank you very, very much for having us today. I'm going to elaborate briefly on the previous statements that health insurance for uninsured children in Oregon would improve their economic security. These benefits for children occur in the short term, and they also persist into adulthood. The research suggests that health insurance for children can have immediate positive impacts on their economic security. As I know you're aware, there is broad evidence that health insurance coverage is linked to the lower likelihood of bankruptcy and to lower medical debt. Children's access to comprehensive health insurance can help protect a family against financial hardship and contribute to the economic welfare of the families in which they live. There's also a growing body of research into the relationship between child health and adult outcomes. In the aggregate, the research shows that children who are healthier have better economic security as adults. One of the most compelling studies on this topic showed that an individual's income, wealth, weeks of worth, and rate of income growth were each positively correlated with better health as children. The study also looked at the effect among siblings, which helped control for environmental factors, and found that a sibling who enjoyed excellent or very good health in childhood earned 24% more than a sibling who was in poor health. In addition, some researchers have looked at the effects of childhood chronic conditions like asthma on adult indicators of success. They found that when not properly controlled, asthma can negatively affect behavioral and educational factors that contribute to higher incomes and other successes as adults. In sum, the sizable body of evidence in this field suggests that ensuring that children can get the care they need would promote their economic success as adults. Lastly, there's evidence that health insurance coverage for children benefits the broader economy. Researchers have found that health insurance for low-income children and pregnant women increased household spending on other consumer goods by the equivalent of $800 per family per year in 2009 dollars. Clearly, Oregon would win by ensuring that all Oregon children have health insurance coverage. Certainly, the children and their families would win, and our economy would win as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share some of this research on this topic.
Thanks so much.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Dave Underreiner. I'm chair of the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Reduction Task Force, as well as CEO for Providence Health and Services. And it's an honor to share the perspective of both organizations around how we reduce and eliminate poverty in Oregon. Before I get into my comments, one of the things that we've learned, and one is poverty is a very complex issue. It covers many things, and it requires lots of coalitions and partnerships and focus, and appreciate the work that the legislature does around it. As you go through my comments, I want to just keep two things in mind. And part of the reason that the Oregon Business Council is involved in this work is jobs create dignity, the notion of work and having work and being able to work, and economic development and it ties the Business Council work and the work of the reducing poverty. The second is we should assure a good childhood for every child in Oregon. And how do we make sure that happens? And as we've talked with folks around the country, focusing on those principles, again, a very complex issue, helps us to create the policies and the programs that will be important as we look at reducing poverty. As an organization driven by our mission to serve the poor and vulnerable, Providence Health and Services fundamentally believes that access to health care is a basic right, particularly for children. As such, we support efforts to expand Medicaid coverage for all children residing in Oregon, regardless of how the child came to reside here. Beyond coverage serving these children's lifelong health and wellness, coverage is incredibly important to the economic stability of families today and the long-term economic success of Oregon. For families struggling to maintain steady employment and housing, healthy children can make a huge difference. With missed school days, parents are able to, with fewer missed school days, parents are able to work more often and have fewer unexpected health care bills. Timely access to wellness checks and vaccinations means manageable health issues do not require or do not become complex health issues and are easier and less expensive to manage. For the children, health insurance coverage is fundamental to future success and opportunity. Studies show that health insurance decreases high school dropout rates and increases college completion. An incredibly important point, particularly when we consider that most of these kids already face significant hurdles based on their economic status, race, and adverse childhood experiences. For the state of Oregon, the economic benefits could be innumerable. To name a few, it supports transformation efforts by rolling children into CCOs at an earlier age, which will reduce high cost utilization and set these children on a healthy path before faced with chronic conditions as an adult. Increased educational achievement will reduce the achievement gap and increase graduation rates, and ultimately create a more skilled and productive workforce. The OBC's Poverty Reduction Task Force goal of reducing the poverty rate to below 10% by 2020 will take thoughtful action across healthcare, education, workforce development, job creation, and safety net reform by public and private institutions. Providence has been a long-time supporter of Medicaid expansion as part of the healthcare reform and believes expanding coverage for all children under 300% of the federal poverty level is a reasonable extension of these efforts. Thank you for the opportunity to provide these comments.
Thank you so much. All right. Okay, to talk about health, CCOs, Martin Kaler and Heather Rayburn.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to testify in support of the Cover All Kids initiative. I'm Heather Rayburn. I'm the Manager of Government Relations for Family Care, which is a CCO serving the Tri-County area. Around 38% of our current membership is children under the age of 18. We consider early childhood health a top priority because we recognize the impact that early childhood health has on setting the path for the future for these children. So we strongly support this initiative to ensure that all children in Oregon have access to coverage. Illness doesn't distinguish between a child who has health coverage and a child who doesn't. And so this means that the health of one child impacts the health of all the children around them. With regular and continuous access to care, a child is more likely to see their provider when they are sick early on in the illness, so that they can receive the necessary treatment or instructions about how long they need to be kept out of school so that they don't return to school while they may still be contagious with an illness and so that they are not infecting other children, affecting all of the other children around them. And as well, then they are getting healthier faster themselves. Also, regular and continuous access to care is really important for the parents of these children. I have a young child myself, and I know how much education you get in those regular well-check visits. You get the information about, okay, if this happens, call me and we'll get you in, or if this happens, you need to go to the emergency room. So I know the difference in symptoms and when I need to go into the office or when I need to go to the emergency room, and that reduces the rate of unnecessary emergency room visits. As well, having that access, knowing that I can call my provider, get my daughter in right away, means that I don't have to sit and make the choice, do I sit and wait and see if she gets better, or do I wait and see if she gets worse? No parent or child should be in the situation where they are faced with that choice of, I don't have a provider, I can't afford to take my daughter to a provider, so I need to sit and wait and see if this gets worse, possibly resulting in a hospitalization or emergency room care that could have been prevented. So for those reasons, we think that Cover All Kids is a great initiative. We support it. We have prioritized childhood health. We think that this initiative is essential to help us keep the promise to our current members and our future members to ensure that we are providing them with the best health care possible and making them as healthy as possible. So thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing Care Oregon and its CCOs at Jackson Care Connect and Columbia Pacific CCO. We provide healthcare services for approximately 200,000 low-income and disabled Oregonians. So before I start, I do want to recognize both your leadership as the chair to have this committee hearing and the Senate President's office willingness to have this committee hearing. This is really the beginning of an important conversation around how we complete the journey we started in 2011, which is to provide health care for all kids. I know when we talked in 2011 about health care for all kids, we missed the asterisk that said except for these kids, but 5 years later, we have a chance to go back and correct that asterisk. Putting this together was a remarkable feat. I think both the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and Children's First for Oregon, who did most of the work of putting these panels together, deserves tremendous credit. It has been a broad and impressive group, and I'm sure you all have caught the significance of family care and Care Oregon sitting shoulder to shoulder. That alone should recognize how important the issue is. So I think the most important thing that's happened since 2011 is that 95% of Oregonians now have health care of some sort. It means that we can focus down on those places that are there still gaps. And one of the most important and obvious gaps are kids who can't establish residency status. To be honest, Care Oregon interacts with these kids a lot. We don't provide them health insurance. We do provide services to organizations like Outgrowing Hunger that provides community garden for refugee populations in East Portland, or ERCO that provides translation services and navigation services for new immigrants to this country and to this state. Frequently, working with those organizations, we encounter folks who are bringing infants, sometimes from nearby in Mexico, other places, other times from places far away, like the war in the Middle East. What they share in common is that they've come here often under very difficult circumstances, often with a lot of trauma, exposed to violence, not getting adequate health care, exposed to the potential of contagious disease. We are able in the moments that we're with them to provide them the services they need that day. We are not in those moments able to put them into a health plan, to coordinate their care, to establish a physician, to treat any chronic or ongoing conditions that they have. We have an opportunity working with community partners like the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and the Oregon Health Equities Alliance to do what we can to raise their story and their visibility. So we're exposed frequently to the needs of people who Care Oregon doesn't serve. And, you know, honestly, the answer that we have to give them is Care Oregon can't help you. And that's not a good enough answer. That's not the answer that Oregon should give those kids. I also want to be clear that there's another population of kids that we don't talk about or think about in this bill. But those are kids that really don't have a residence because their families live in cars and move from state to state, or they migrate from one job to the next, or their families that are so broken up that they might surf from one family to another. They're not Oregon residents because they're not residents of a state. They're kids. They're moving around where their families are moving around or wherever they're getting shuffled off to. Those kids still deserve health care. They still deserve the opportunity to be successful in school. They still deserve an opportunity to live a happy life as an adult. And being in the healthcare system is part of that path. And there are also the downtown Portland youth. A lot of those are kids that have run away from families that are abusive. They escaped a torture that they had on a daily basis in the homes they were from, but they escaped that without a birth certificate or a Social Security card because they don't tell you when you're going to run away from home, bring your ID. It's very hard to reestablish your ID. And those kids, too, can't establish residency. So let's recognize that in a lot of ways, we're already doing things for these kids, but the things we're doing are through social service programs, by episodic care at a safety net clinic or one of the community health centers. We're doing it in little ways, with little costs, but it's not organized, so we're deferring a whole lot of cost. And that's the second thing we should talk about. What is the real cost for this population? These are traumatized people, and we know that traumatized people spend the rest of their life dealing with that trauma. It impacts their education. It impacts the likelihood they'll end up in the correction system. It impacts the likelihood that they'll have successful work lives, and it impacts the likelihood they'll have successful family lives. And that also reoccurs in families from one generation to the next. The best time to reach those people is when they're kids, when they're experiencing that trauma. It also is the impact of all of the things they've been exposed to from a health impact standpoint that we're not getting to early enough, whether it's dental care, psychological care, or the risk of immunization, or not being immunized, or not addressing the contagious disease. So when you created CCS, you charged us with something. You charged us with a responsibility not just to provide health insurance for low-income people, but in the statute you charged us to connect to the public health system. And we do that in so many ways. We connect to our counties, to our community health improvement plans, to the hubs. We have population health programs, but we can only do so much for these kids doing all of those secondary things. Supporting the public health system is our charge, and we will do that charge better if you have this population of kids in the CCO environment, and we promise we can do a good job for you. So I guess my plea today is to say, let's take the asterisks off these kids, let's put them into an environment where the costs we spend are deliberate and effective, and let the CCOs do the job you asked us to do.
Thanks so much. Questions? Thanks so much. Josh Ballack and Dr. Paul Lewis are insurance and health providers.
Go ahead, doctor. Go ahead.
And Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here this afternoon. My name is Paul Lewis. I serve as the Multnomah County Health Officer. I've also been a practicing pediatrician for 29 years, so I bring my personal passion for this issue with me as well. In some ways, my profession has a pretty simple moral compass. We just put kids and families first. Art Jaffe, one of my mentors and former president of the Pediatric Society, always said the same thing whenever I came with problems, which was, when in doubt, do the right thing. And that's, I think, a theme we've already heard today. Pediatricians like kids more than adults. That's who we'd rather hang out with. We laugh a lot. We also cry a lot. And we don't like to see kids suffer. We deal with a lot of tough situations. Moms lose babies. Sometimes even worse, babies lose moms. There's cancer in toddlers, cancer in teenagers. There's child abuse. There's a lot of tough stuff, but again, it's fairly easy to try to do the right thing for the kids. But less easy to navigate are the situation where the kids don't get care or the care is late because of rules, bureaucracy, or lack of coverage. This is not very easy for a moral compass. We can't see why one kid should get care over another or one kid should get the preventative care and another one not. One of my most persistent medical memories slash nightmares didn't start very dramatically. I was seeing a four-year-old Latino boy in an urgent care clinic for some minor complaint. I can't even remember what it was. I always examine the kids' easy things first, but when I finally got ready to look in the mouth and throat, I wasn't ready for what I encountered. This kid was only four. I had most of his baby teeth, but didn't really have any teeth. All that was left was little white rims around craters of essentially 100% tooth decay, upper and lower. I actually looked to try to find a normal tooth. I was a professor. I was looking for all the things that could cause this. I think it could have been a genetic disease or a bad nutrition or poor parenting. But the real problem was no insurance and no access to care. Your mouth doesn't rot overnight. It takes a lot of time. And he didn't deserve to have the pain that was certain to follow him throughout his life or the disfigurement that would follow from this kind of tooth decay, especially since most of it was preventable. What I did with 15 minutes I had and no access to resources for him, I can't remember, but I do remember is that mouth. You've heard from our panelists about the educational, equity, and economic benefits of keeping all kids covered. I like the comment about the asterisk. We don't need any asterisks. Every kid deserves the chance to reach their full potential. Otherwise, they're shortchanged, but so are we. We're all getting older. We need their hard work and creativity to solve the many problems of tomorrow. Our county health department serves many of our low-income residents and community of colors. Our clinics see over 72,000 such people each year in our medical and dental clinics. I'm grateful for the strides Oregon has made during my 20 years in Oregon toward universal coverage for children, but too many still are without health insurance. In our county clinics, we see about 30,000 kids each year. In 2015, 11% were uninsured. We still saw them in our school-based health centers, dental clinics, home visiting programs, WIC, and primary care clinics. I'm glad these kids received the care they did. Did they get it on time? Would they come back for more? And can our system sustain providing care to everyone if such a substantial percentage of care is uncompensated? More than 13% of our residents are foreign-born. Many foreign-born residents, including Latinos, live in households with mixed immigrant status. This means that family members and relatives are a mix of native-born citizens, naturalized citizens, legal permanent residents, and undocumented individuals. Undocumented individuals and their families live in fear of discovery, detention, and deportation. Mixed-status families, in particular uninsured mothers, may compromise their children's health when they're fearful to seek their own coverage or delay care for their children. Please think about doing the right thing for all kids, including those that have fallen into this gap. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, All Care Health. We're a coordinated care organization, and amongst other things, down in Southern Oregon, Jackson, Josephine, and a bit of Douglas County. You know, I think Mr. Taylor actually did a really good job talking about how CCOs really are charged to improve the health of the community. And we see this as part of that effort, that really we are supposed to be out there and be able to help everybody. But I also think that it's important to know, as a provider-led organization, that we would much rather see kids with pneumonia in our offices and make sure that they end up getting antibiotics as opposed to the fallout of them being super sick in an ER and spending 3 days there trying to get their lungs pumped out. So for us, it's a really simple, really basic way. This is a much easier way. We're going to end up treating these kids one way or another. How about we just do it the right way? You know, and I think it's also really important to say that we are, as CCOs, starting to invest more time in schools and these types of things. Well, doesn't it make sense? And we do. We end up getting services for the whole school. Well, let's make sure that these kids can see our doctors too. So it just seems to make sense. I also just wanted to kind of give a big shout out to Linda Roman. I think that she's done an amazing job. That slide up there of 60, 70, 80 organizations signing on to this thing is a testament to her hard work. And I think shows a lot of fortitude on their part, and I think a commitment to come back in 17 and really address this issue. So thank you to the committee, and hopefully we'll be back here soon.
That's right. Thank you. And the final person, our illustrious Senator Arne Rublin.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson and committee. For the record, my name is Arne Rublin, Senate District 5, most of the Oregon coast. I'm speaking to you today as a previous high school principal and teacher, and with over 60 organizations that have signed on to have a conversation about covering all kids, I felt it was important to come and share my feelings about why this bill is so important for kids. In those 32 years I spent at the same high school in the same little town of Coos Bay, as a math teacher, as a dean of students, as a vice principal, and as a principal, health care was always one of the things that I had to deal with. When I was the dean of students, my school nurse got cancer, and so we didn't really have a school nurse most of that year, and so our office became the triage place to figure out what was going on, and I got to know more about the different diseases that our kids brought with them every day, chronic diseases. We were the depository for their medications. They had to come into our office, and I got to know and deal with them and feel how they felt coming out of classrooms to take care of themselves and to do the right things and having general health care for most of them. And I recognized that that was just the tip of the iceberg. There were a lot of kids sitting in those classrooms that didn't have any health care. And so it was my mission to get a clinic at our school. And it took me most of those 32 years. And we finally got a real community health clinic on our grounds after I graduated from the 32 years at the high school. And I've watched the opportunities that kids have now that they didn't have before, that was really important to me. Health care coverage is essential to all of our children. They need our children have the health care they need. When they are growing, having health insurance promotes health and preserves their ability to learn and to be active participants in the school districts they're in. We have some kids who are not covered right now, and they need to be. It was always an interesting dilemma when you were in high school, because we had a student one time who was working in his home ec class, and the needle broke off and stuck in his eye. And he came to my office, and we had to figure out what to do with how to get this kid taken care of. We're getting a hold of healthcare people. We're trying to figure out if he has insurance, and then we just don't care. I mean, the issue is get him to the hospital, get it taken care of. It turned out it was a lot worse than it looked than it was when the doctor finally got there. I will tell you the other thing that happened in small communities. I had a number of providers when I was dean of students, dentists and others, who came up to the high school and said, if you get a hold of the parents and you have kids that don't have health care and don't have dental care, we will take care of it. Just get them people to us. The same was true of clothing. The same was true of all the other kinds of needs that many of our kids had. There were people in our community that said, it's more important. We just need to be acknowledge and know when it's coming. You heard today great leadership from educators, public policy experts, children's advocates, and health industry leaders from across the state. And like them, I believe cover all kids is simply the right thing to do. I want to give another short little explanation, because I think as a teacher, my mother was always amazed that I became a teacher, because I was one of those kids that was very sick as a little kid. I had bronchitis annually, so I missed up to 10 days at a time. I had migraine headaches that created problems. So the first 5 years of my life, I never made it to first day of school. I got so anxious and whatever, I would get migraine headaches, and I'd be at home in the dark with a cover over my head because I couldn't handle the light. And all that did was make it really difficult to go back to school, because you were always behind. And I will tell you, when you miss 10 days of school because of a chronic illness, that first day back is really difficult. Friends are asking what happened to you. You're trying to figure it out. You get a big handful of material to catch up on, and you always feel like you were behind. And I had health care. My best friend's dad was my doctor. I mean, it was really, I had all those advantages. And I think at times, and when I was doing the work at the high school, about all those kids that didn't have that advantage and how many more days they missed of school because they didn't have it, their illnesses became bigger illnesses. It's shocking to me that many of them make it through school, and I know that a lot do not, especially when they get to the high school level. They just finally give up because they can't make it on their own. And so as I was thinking about it, it's also kids are kids. No child deserves to go to school without a prescription eyewear. If you can't see the board, you really can't get the work done. Without asthma medication, you know, when kids can't breathe, they don't really want to be around school, and they can't do anything else. And having our family had a number of my cousins and my family that had asthma, and I watched as they struggled and got their medication so they could actually breathe again. Without medication, I really, again, don't know what happens. And I know some of those kids don't survive. The children are classmates and playmates. They deserve the same opportunity to succeed in school as all children who have access to health coverage. And just like any other child, their health, well-being contributes to their success at school. Unhealthy kids do not do well at school, just like hungry kids do not do well at school. My wife is an elementary principal, and we used to have these conversations about, I mean, we bought hundreds of blankets because kids would go home and they froze all night long because they didn't have that. So we just, in elementary school, you just had to have blankets. And when kids indicated they had a problem, you gave them a blanket. And those of us who have not ever sat in those situations and been in those places have no understanding how hard it is to get up the next morning and come to school because they didn't get a lot of sleep. Because when you're cold, it's really hard to sleep. Oregon could and should ensure that every child has a pathway to success. We've made a progress in some of our kids, but not all of our kids. We need to work together to fix this in 2017. Because children are children, covering all kids is simply the right thing to do. it is very difficult to look a mother in the face and say we really don't have any options for you when their kid is sick and trying to figure out what to do. And so I am eternally grateful to those professionals in my community who made sure that we knew that they were available to help that parent so I could have an alternative, an option for them. We shouldn't have to do that. We should have figured out a way to make sure that all kids are covered, have the health care they need, so that they can be as successful as they can possibly be. I encourage you to continue to work with the 60 organizations or more that are behind us to craft a bill that we can move forward in 2017 to make sure that principals that sit in my principal seat in the future don't have to have the same difficult feelings about how to help each and every one of their children be successful. And I thank you, and I'm answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I'm excited. September 26th, I think, is the first day that we can start our pre-session filing, and the end of pre-session is December 21st. I would love to see a bill in before the pre-session filing date so that we can get an early start on this next session. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the informational hearing, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4122. And I think Paul Holvey will start us off, if that's all right.
Do you want Amy and Heidi to come up, too?
And Amy Van Son and Heidi Jimenez.
Jimenez.
Oh, hello.
Some testimony for you that came in late. I assume she must all come up at the same time.
I don't know.
Did you want us all up at the same time, or should we?
I want Paul to go first.
Right.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Paul Holvey. I'm a state representative from District 8, which is in South Lane County. Thank you for allowing a public hearing on House Bill 4122 this afternoon. This bill is a bill that would require Oregon to label genetically engineered, or not Oregon to label, but an Oregon requirement that genetically engineered fish that are for sale for human consumption be labeled as genetically engineered. There's a substantial state interest in seeing that these newly created fish are labeled. Oregon consumers have expressed their concerns about the impacts genetically engineered fish might have on the environment, their health, and not the least of importance is Oregon's fishing industry and economy. Many retail stores have recognized those interests and concerns of consumers by announcing their intent not to sell genetically engineered fish. House Bill 4122A defines genetically engineered for the record, and it also makes some specific findings. It finds primarily that Oregon consumers have the right to be fully informed about the purchases they make and the fish that they are purchasing for their consumption. I think it is important to note that there's a lot of information about genetically engineered fish, and certainly the FDA has approved genetically engineered fish as safe for human consumption. That is contained in an amendment that I presented to the committee in the Dash 4 amendment, that statement that was requested by Mr. Peden representing Pacific Seafood. And so I have provided that amendment to the committee. I also provided a Dash 5 amendment which to the committee that was requested from Katie Fast of the Oregonians for Food and Shelter that basically says that if the feds created a labeling requirement for a genetically engineered fish, that it would essentially preempt Oregon's labeling. Legislative Council gave me an opinion and confirmed that that would be the case and didn't really think it was necessary to state in the bill, but I provided that statement for to provide some comfort, I assume, to those that were opposing and perhaps still are opposing this bill. So I'm not sure of the whether to go forward with that particular amendment or not at this point. There is a tremendous amount of concern from the Oregon Salmon Commission about genetically engineered fish coming into the marketplace in Oregon. It could have the impact of negatively driving their prices down for their fish, also creating a great deal of confusion with consumers of not knowing whether the fish they happen to be buying is genetically engineered or not. And certainly many have expressed their concern about not knowing could actually impact their willingness to eat fish at all. And that, I think, is something that this particular commodity commission is tasked with, looking at those issues, and they have made that recommendation to this legislature. And I think it's incumbent upon us to listen to them. We also have supporting this legislation is the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and the Native Fish Society, Trout Unlimited, Desert Springs Trout Farms, as well as very concerned about the introduction of genetically engineered fish into the marketplace, because we're not sure how people would distinguish between a farmed hybrid fish, for example, and a genetically engineered farmed fish. A great deal of concern to that fish farming community. I also wanted to point out some real simple things, I suppose. They don't seem so simple to many, but this whole discussion about whether there's environmental risk, the discussion about whether there's health impacts are most of the conclusions that the FDA have come to have been really based on a narrow review of information supplied by the manufacturer of this particular fish. And there's been a lot of other studies that have questioned the transparency and also the integrity of many of those studies. For example, in the EPA finding that just recently came out in November, they basically stated that from Aqua Bounty's own figures, the viability of some of these eggs that are being produced in Canada is only their triploid treatment of that is only 95% successful, that there's potentially 5% that would be viable eggs. Now, you know, in the environmental impact statement that the Food and Drug Administration does, they don't look at Canada and they don't look at Panama where these fish are being grown. They only look at the United States. But I submit to you that we in putting millions of eggs in an airplane and flying them over the United States territory and waters, that there is a risk. And the Food and Drug Administration says the risk is low in several cases in their determination that this fish would be approved for human consumption. I think for Oregon and many of the Pacific Coast states, a low risk is too much. Any risk, I think, could have potential devastating impacts on our industry and potentially our environment. If we were to see Canada introduce another plant where they grow these eggs on the West Coast in British Columbia, which nothing would prevent them from doing that, we would be even in more danger, I think, from something happening with these eggs. The thing that really stands out to me in this whole thing is that we do need consumers' ability to understand and know for sure what fish they are eating and whether or not they are genetically engineered or not. People have the right to know, to make their own decisions about whether the science is says that it's safe or not safe, to make their own decision about whether they want to support a fish that may or may not have an environmental consequence, but certainly most of all, they should be able to make a statement with their purchases that supports our own fishing industry, and not to have it undermined by confusion amongst consumers of not knowing where their fish originates from and whether or not it's genetically engineered. The idea that we would rely on a voluntary labeling system that's being proposed right now in Congress concerns me greatly. The fact that there has been a bill put in place that's going to require labeling once this before this fish can come into the U.S. market is in an appropriation bill that expires this fiscal year. After that bill expires, that requirement also expires. The FDA has also stated that they did not intend on requiring labeling of genetically engineered fish.
So I have a question on that. I was given information that a law was passed. I mean, it actually became law on December 18th, 2015. And I'll just read it. During the fiscal year 2016, which we're in right now, the Food and Drug Administration shall not allow the introduction or delivery for introduction into interstate commerce any food that contains genetically engineered salmon until FDA publishes final labeling guidelines for informing consumers of such content. So to me, that tells me that right now the salmon can't, these genetically GMO salmon can't come into the United States until there is a federal labeling.
I think the key to that is during the fiscal year 2016 is the first thing you read.
Mm-hmm.
And in checking with our congressional delegation about this particular section of law, they confirmed to me that, yes, indeed, when this fiscal legislation expires, which I believe is in September 2016, this requirement expires with it. And that's why it says during the fiscal year 2016, that's a requirement.
And the fiscal year is January 1 to December?
My understanding, no, it the fiscal year ends, the federal fiscal year ends in, for this legislation, ends in August.
August.
September.
Or September.
September.
30th. September 30th.
I think it's an October 1.
Yeah, they have an October 1 fiscal year.
Pretty close.
Okay. So if we don't get this through, though, this time, Paul, we can
I'll answer all those, but
you know, certainly address this issue in 2017.
Well, that may be true, but with pending legislation also that's going to try to preempt states from doing their own labeling being introduced last Friday on this issue, it does raise concern. The state of Alaska has already required labeling of genetically engineered fish, very similar to this legislation. And I really, you know, I think there is a little bit more urgency in getting a law in place because of that uncertainty about whether labeling will be required. And I have asked legislative counsel as well for an opinion on Oregon's interest in doing that. And you know, I'm certainly prepared to, if I haven't already given that to the committee administrator, I can give that legal opinion. I can read just a short little section of it if you decide you want to have time for that. Although the significance of genetically engineered foods in foods may be controversial, the presence or absence of genetically engineered fish in a product is not controversial and does not imply a viewpoint concerning genetically engineered fish in food. Therefore, the labeling required by the -3 amendment, which is now House Bill 4122A, is both factual and uncontroversial. It also goes on to say that this House bill would not unduly burden interstate commerce as well. I think the interest for Oregonians being that the fishing industry is so important to our culture, certainly to Native Americans as well, and to our industry, is one of the most overwhelming statements that needs to be made. And, you know, with all due respect, I do see some urgency to this discussion. I do think it's important for Oregon to make a stand on this and not wait for federal inaction or federal action that would be contrary to the interest, what I see the interest of a large segment of our population and part of our economy. You know, I think it's really, you know, we have so many stores that have reacted to this that say they don't want to carry it because people are demanding to know. And they're trying to react to this. We really, I mean, we have Costco, Kroger, Safeway, a whole host of retail outlets that are making statements like this because consumers are demanding this information. And I think it's incumbent upon us to listen to our consumers, to listen to the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and to listen to our Salmon Commission in this regard, and listen to the concerns of people who really are scared of this genetic engineering of animals, the first animal that's genetically engineered for human consumption. And it just is, for many, is too important to let pass. So I will let you go. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
We need to move on.
Does Representative Krieger want to testify?
Let's finish here. I don't know if Representative Krieger.
He's enjoying
testimony. Okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amy Van Son. I'm an attorney with the Center for Food Safety. I'd like to thank Representative Holvey for sponsoring this bill and coming today to speak about it as well. We at the Center for Food Safety are in support of HB 4122A. Which again requires labeling of genetically engineered fish by 2018. I'll just start by kind of introducing Center for Food Safety. We're a nationwide nonprofit public interest organization. We represent over 750,000 consumers and farmers across the country, and tens of thousands of those are here in Oregon. Our mission is to empower people, support farmers, and protect the earth from harmful industrial agriculture. We have a long history of working in genetically engineered foods, and we have advocated for a long time for federal, state, and local regulation and labeling of genetically engineered foods and to address their economic and environmental impacts. I'd like to just back up and talk a little bit about what genetic engineering means, because it is different than traditional selective breeding. And I think that needs to be made clear. Genetic engineering, or GE, as we abbreviate it, means that an organism has been engineered with changes at its genetic level, at the molecular level, that could never have happened in nature or through any natural reproductive processes, even those in a lab. It's different than traditional breeding, and it involves the insertion of genes from an unrelated organism, or perhaps the silencing of genes within that organism. So it is different, and that just needs to be stressed. We've worked since 2001 to try to prevent the introduction of the genetically engineered salmon, the Aqua Bounty, Aqua Advantage salmon specifically, that was approved by FDA last year. We filed many legal petitions to try to get the government to reject that, and we've gotten commitments from hundreds of grocery stores, as was mentioned, including Target, Trader Joe's, Costco, that say they won't sell this fish. As to labeling, we've been very involved in labeling of genetically engineered foods on the nationwide level and as to all foods, and specifically as to GE salmon. We helped draft and pass that law that was in Alaska to require the labeling of GE fish that was passed in 2005. And we've worked, and our model bills have been used in dozens of state legislative efforts, including the successful ones in Connecticut, Maine, and Vermont. We've also been participating in the defense of Vermont's GE labeling law, so far successful. I'll just get into the specifics. I think that I want to first address your questions as to whether this requirement congressional mandate on FDA in the appropriations act makes it so we can just wait here and we don't have to act. And I would say emphatically, no, we should act now. We should not wait. First of all, HB 4122 addresses all genetically engineered fish, not just the salmon that were approved last year. And this congressional mandate to FDA is only as to those approved GE salmon. That's one line of approved genetically engineered fish, not all the ones coming down the pike in the future. Additionally, as was brought up, this is a appropriations bill that has to be redone every 6 months. It will sunset, so we don't know yet whether that will happen. And finally, we don't know what the content of FDA's labeling guidelines will be or the strength of them. While we have hope that they will require clear on-package labeling, we're not sure. FDA has never required labeling of GE foods in the past. So all that is to say, there's no reason to wait here in Oregon, and we should go ahead and do this because it supports a consumer's right to know. Three general goals, I think, are going to be really supported by this act. One is a reduction in consumer confusion as to what they're purchasing. The second is a tool for tracking any potential human health issues, including novel new allergies. This is a first GE animal ever for human consumption. We simply don't know what it will do to human health. And the third goal is to support our Pacific Northwest and Oregon fishermen and women. Over 64 countries have labeling for GE foods. We do not in the U.S. However, polls have repeatedly shown that over 90% of Americans want this kind of labeling, and specifically they want labeling for GE salmon. It's important to remember that this change is at the molecular level, which means that while it's important to a lot of consumers, they can't tell from the outside of the package what whether it's genetically engineered or not. We'll go on to mention that, like I said, this is the first animal approved for human consumption, but it is not the last, likely not the last. Aqua Bounty itself is already working on genetically engineered trout and tilapia, and other companies are working on other genetically engineered salmon and catfish. So we are likely to see more fish in the future. This bill, 4122, covers all genetically engineered fish, not just the salmon. So that's a big thing to remember. As to the health issues, while the FDA has said that this particular salmon is safe, the claims of the science behind it is not, there's not actually a consensus. There's no scientific consensus as to whether GE foods generally are safe for human consumption. The problem is that we just don't have any idea. We have no long-term epidemiological studies in the U.S. that have confirmed any effects of GE foods on the human, or, on the American public. And although FDA did do what they called, a human health assessment when they were looking at the GE salmon that was recently approved, there were some serious questions brought up in that process. First of all, they shoehorned that approval for GE salmon into their authority over animal drugs, even though a salmon is not a drug, and that it was for human consumption. And a lot of organizations, including my own, had big questions about whether FDA's evaluation of the safety of GE animals was actually a thorough enough evaluation. They relied only on industry data, and because it was under the drug approval, it was a somewhat closed-door process, and they did not release sufficient enough data for the public to actually have oversight of that. Again, this is all to say that we're not sure what the human health effects are of eating GE salmon, and so Madam consumers Chair. Should have the right to decide.
I just need to cut in for a second. Unfortunately, Senator Steiner Hayward and I have to go to Ways and Means to ensure there's a quorum. I did want to put on the record that I would be supportive of this, would be supportive of keeping the bill alive. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I just want to let you know that I appreciate you coming and want to make that note.
And I want to associate myself with Senator Shields' comments. I do support this, and I think it's essentially analogous to the biosimilars bill that we passed earlier. We don't really need it but right this minute, but we're going to. So people thought that was important. I think this one is too. And I apologize, Representative, for having to leave. Thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you.
I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I do.
We have 10 minutes, and 10 we
minutes?
Have
okay.
Five more people.
I will cede, and I will just say that I've submitted lengthy written testimony, and I would submit that to you. And thank you so much for having us and taking the time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Heidi Jimenez, and I live in Hood River, Oregon. I am in support of HB 4122 that requires labeling of genetically engineered fish. As both a mom and a nurse, I came here today to ask you as our elected officials to give Oregon moms the basic right to know what we are feeding our children and families. I am a nurse and a mom who is very concerned about public health, and I have no interest in either eating genetically engineered salmon or serving them to my son. When I go to the store, I want to be sure that the salmon I'm buying is real salmon caught from the ocean or from the river and not something that was genetically engineered with an eel-like fish in a laboratory. To me, this is a very simple issue of consumer rights. Why is the company Aqua Bounty so afraid to let consumers know what it is they're buying? Aqua Bounty says that the modified fish are safe and that they are the same as wild salmon. But why not give Oregonians the right to decide for themselves? There's no good argument that it would be a major burden to label GMO salmon, and I can tell you that I, like many other consumers, will not be buying any salmon if we can't be sure that we are buying salmon that is not genetically engineered. This may not be fair for Oregon salmon fishermen, but it is easy to prevent if Oregon simply lets consumers know whether the fish they are buying is genetically engineered. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. All right. L. Val Giddings and Ian Tolleson. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Senator Canope, good afternoon. My name is Ian Tolleson. I am the Government Affairs Director for Northwest Food Processors Association. Our membership covers food makers in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We make food in fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, and seafood. And we sell this across not only the nation but the globe. I'm here today to oppose this bill. We feel that this this type of label is best at the federal level. The FDA is the federal agency that's in charge of all labeling standards, whether it's nutrition facts or what have you. In creating a patchwork of regulation, we feel actually adds further confusion to the consumer. Consumers that live on the borders of a state should be able to have the same consistent and reliable information, whether they buy that, say, in Portland or in Vancouver. Having an inconsistent label does not provide consumers the information they would like to know. Furthermore, there are a variety of traits the industry uses to genetically engineer their, whether it's crop or now we're getting into the world of fish. There's nothing in this bill that would say what that trait is for, that doesn't tell the consumer, why a particular food was genetically engineered. So we think that's a problem. I would agree with Representative Holvey. I think Oregonians should be able to weigh into this. And you know what? They have. Ballot Measure 92 was just brought to the voters' attention in 2014, and they rejected the notion that you should label goods that are made with genetically engineered food. I think that's an important thing to know. And I would say that our food processors that process a variety of crops, whether that's conventional, it's GE, it's organic, we run the gamut. In order to substantiate the claim of having something GE, you really have to have the entire food supply system and the paperwork set up to then support that claim, because with food labeling, you cannot put misleading information out there. And that will add a cost. That will raise food prices. You know, there's been a few mentions of health and science. It was said that the science is not a consensus. I don't know what issue all scientists come to a consensus on, but I will tell you on this issue, It is very, very close. And I would say the scientific information that I have seen, there is more scientific consensus on the safety of genetically engineered foods than there is on global warming. I think it's somewhere around the 90% of all scientists would agree with this. And lastly, I would say consumers do, I was here, do consumers have a right to know? But yet, why don't they have a right to learn? There is all this information out there that is available, so people can get the information out there to know what is in their foods, how it's made, and the safety standards that this is done. Whether it's salmon, corn, soybean, many of these crops or fish go through a rigorous scientific study. And this is not put out there in a couple years, 2 years. Many times it's over many, many years. I think with salmon it was about 25 years. So that's pretty wide consensus. There has been billions of people that have eaten trillions of meals made with genetically engineered crops, and not one safety issue has come up. That's a very important thing to keep in mind. So with that, I will conclude, and you can ask me any questions if you like. Thank you.
Chairman Wannis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Knopf, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon and testify on this bill. My name is Val Giddings. I am here at the request of the Biotechnology Industry Organization. I am an independent consultant. I'm also a senior fellow with the Information Technology and Information Foundation in Washington, D.C. I am here because I have a PhD in genetics. I have worked in this area with transgenic foods and crops for more than three decades. I spent 5 years advising Congress on these issues. I've worked for the World Bank. I spent a decade as a regulator with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I, in my capacity as an independent consultant, I have clients including the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, governments, NGOs, and companies around the world. And I am intimately familiar with this particular product, having followed it closely over more than 25 years. I find it very interesting that the arguments raised against this fish have changed almost not at all from the day that it was first introduced into the public conversation. Unfortunately, many people know a lot about this fish that happens to be contradicted by the facts. Virtually all of the comments that you have heard from previous speakers advancing different justifications as to why this bill is necessary are contradicted by the facts and by data. I would be delighted to work through any and all of them with you at length. I understand our time is limited, but let me address the issue of scientific consensus, the definition of genetic modification, on which you've heard previous speakers make some comments. As my colleague has just pointed out, the scientific consensus on the safety of crops and foods improved through biotechnology is stronger than is the scientific consensus globally on anthropogenic climate change. Do not take my word for anything that I'm telling you today. If you want to find out information on consensus, if you will Google the terms with any search engine you wish and enter GM Safe Consensus 270, you will go to a webpage, Si Quiero Transgénicos, put up by a colleague of mine from Mexico, who has documented more than 270 organizations, competent and credible scientific organizations around the world, including the Academies of Sciences of the United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, all the developing nations, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the American Medical Association, the British Medical Society, and on and on and on, confirming the safety of these technologies to produce the foods and crops that have been consumed, as you've heard, in literally trillions of meals by billions of people for decades with no confirmed cases of harm to human or livestock. There have been many allegations made of negative consequences, none of which have held up under scrutiny. You've also heard a definition of genetic modification as something that takes place using techniques to produce genetic combinations that would never have occurred in nature. In point of actual fact, everything that genetic engineers use to produce transgenic organisms, such as this salmon, is based on techniques found in nature. the enzymes that genetic engineers use to cut and paste DNA and move the DNA fragments from one species to another, they've learned how to do by finding genes moving between species in nature. There's no such thing as unrelated species. All the species that we find living on planet Earth are related by descent with modification, and we've known that for well over since 1859. The techniques and technologies that we use today with recombinant DNA methods in the laboratory are far more precise, predictable, and therefore ensured of safety than the conventional breeding that we use that everybody recognizes as safe. For example, durum wheat is derived through radiation mutagenesis, in which wheat seeds were taken exposed to a source of ionizing radiation, cobalt-60, and literally fried, exposed to high doses of radiation that made thousands upon thousands of uncharacterized changes where you had no ability to predict whatsoever. And the results have led to the durum wheat that we use for all our pasta and bread today, and everyone accepts and recognizes that it's safe. In this particular case, you've heard the allegations made that the FDA's analysis of this was non-transparent and inadequate. I would encourage you to look at the references that I have provided in my testimony, which will take you to the website where the FDA has shared the documentation of their analysis of this fish. There is no fish in the history of humanity that has been subjected to more scrutiny in advance, in depth and detail, than this fish. Every reasonable question that could be asked about the safety of this fish, both for humans and the environment, has been asked and has been answered. And at the end of these extensive considerations, the FDA concluded that this salmon is a salmon like other salmon, and it is indistinguishable in any respect relevant to health, safety, or nutrition from any other salmon, and therefore does not require a label that would stigmatize it, as the opponents of this salmon would like to do, who have made very clear their intention to use a mandatory label not to inform consumers, but to mislead and deceive them about the safety of the food so labeled, so they can drive it from the market. I could go on, but I would like to leave time for any questions that you may have, particularly about specific claims made about the safety for either the environment or for human health with this salmon.
And I certainly have not done any research in this. This bill was just dropped in our lap last Thursday, I think, or Friday. So this is the first hearing on it. I used to be in research biology. I got my master's in biochemistry, but and I'm a nurse, public health nurse. So I think I represent quite a few people, though, who love our salmon. Want to eat our salmon, and there is a fear of genetically modified GMO food because it's an animal, but that's not based on the science. They used to say that nicotine was not cancer causing or addictive. We have so much more asthma, we have so much more food allergies amongst our children, et cetera. Is this caused by, who knows what causes that? And I don't think we would ever be able to really prove that. So I think there's, even though we don't have actual research, there's still that fear out in the public, and I know that this is popular. Yeah, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. First question would be, I know that a genetically modified crop has to jump through a massive number of hoops at the federal level before it's ever allowed to be grown in the United States. I think through 6 different agencies, I believe. So would it be safe to say that there is not a genetically modified crop grown in the United States that is in any way, shape, or form harmful to humans or animals?
That's absolutely correct, sir, yes.
Okay. And if I could, Madam Chair, there has been a lot of benefits to genetically modified crops, especially a specific rice crop. That is saving lives of a lot of children in the Far East. Would that be correct as well?
Well, yes and no. There have been substantial and significant benefits documented from the use of biotech-improved crops worldwide, where they're grown by more than 18 million farmers in 28 countries around the world legally, and by an unknown number illegally, where those farmers can get access to these seeds through porous borders when their governments have lagged in delivering approvals. The case that you mentioned of the rice that has the potential for saving lives and preventing blindness in large areas of Southeast Asia and mm-hmm. Africa, unfortunately that rice is not yet on the market. It is in development by Erie. It was produced originally by researchers from universities in Switzerland, private sector, public sector researchers working on public money. They've developed a technique that they think will prevent the host of medical deficiencies resulting from vitamin A deficiency. Mm-hmm. But this rice, golden rice,
yes.
Developed by Ingo Petrakis and Peter Beyer, friends of mine, is not on the market. It is still stuck in field trials that are being pursued primarily for answering unjustified questions about the safety of this product.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that when you have a population that has significant vitamin deficiencies and you find a way to solve those problems, but it also speaks to the fact that the bureaucracy may be slow and may be cumbersome, but they cover everything before they eventually get there. So there's a frustration here, but it's also, I think, a security knowing that how many hoops have to be jumped through before it's ever authorized.
There are no unresolved safety questions about any of these foods or products.
Owen, yes.
Just Mr. Giddings,
yes,
you mentioned your testimony.
Yes.
We did not receive anything from you. Is that something that you can send to us electronically?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
It will be done.
Welcome to Oregon. Thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate that. I'm so sorry that we don't really have more time to discuss this issue, but with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And the final three, Tom Wolf, Joe, is it Rolitter, and Jim Myron.
Did I mutilate it?
Rolitter. Joe's been mutilated for
I'll
years.
I'll respond to almost anything that has some consonants together. Start from R. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolitter. I get my mail in Walport, Oregon. I live out in the Tuliberries by there. I'm here today representing the Oregon Salmon Commission, and the Salmon Commission is industry-funded commodity commission organized under the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We're here today to support House Bill 4122A. I think in the short time here, I'd just like to say that we think this is just a labeling bill. We're not going to argue about the safety or the anything else. It's just we want people to know that they're buying a genetically engineered product versus our wild caught product. And we've done the work necessary to get our labels of wild caught copyrighted, and we're very proud of the quality of our fish. We've learned so much over the years about how to produce, how to deliver to the fish plant a product that's really a beautiful, healthy, well taken care of product. And we'd like to preserve that. And so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here representing Trout Unlimited, which is the largest cold water conservation group in the country. I've already sent an electronic copy of my testimony. I just want to emphasize that we think this is a great bill that we support because it gives consumers a choice. One of the areas that we think they need a choice, they need to choose between a genetically engineered fish and wild-caught salmon, which brings money into the our commercial fishing industry. And we think that's right there is a valid reason to support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing Native Fish Society. We supported the bill, the Dash A engrossed version that came out of the House, and we still support it. I've taken a quick look at the Dash 4s and 5s, I believe they are, and I don't think either one of those are necessary. So we still support the bill as it's in front of you, and we're disappointed that it's not going to be moving. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I do support the bill also. I'm a public health nurse. I always am looking for wild fish. I'll never buy anything that's farmed. I also believe in organic foods. I love, I try to choose organic. I'm just one of those kinds of people, and I like that choice, and that's why I like the idea of labeling. But it is a short session. It is 35 days, and I'm sorry that we won't have more time to discuss that. Comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 4122, and we are adjourned.